Welcome back from the break. We talked already about the role of algorithms in social media today in the panel on media and education. And yesterday we already had the discussion in the context of the roots for a democratic and peaceful society. And then we also had some side discussions about narratives around protests and around social media discussions and how they play a role today. And now we have a talk about peace building in the digital era with Andrew Sutayo and Dava Abdullah. And I give you the floor for the talk now. It will be about 35 minutes, and so that we can have 10-15 minutes Q&A afterwards. Give a warm applause to the reference. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Hi, everybody. My name is Davar Muhammad. I'm a journalist working for a local media organization called Kurdistan 24, based in Iraqi Kurdistan region. Today, we will be presenting, to me, it's a really interesting topic, and also a very new one. As I have jumped into this world almost very recently. And the reason that I really wanted to take part in this was to really encourage people and also deliver and convey the significance of peace building efforts digitally. It has been a topic for a very long time, but as with the rapid growth of technology and digital media, we are more in need of this critical tool in our lives. So today, I'll be talking about peace and conflict and digital era with my colleague Andrew, who will be presenting the technical part of a very important tool that will be helpful in terms of achieving the end goal, which is achieving peace and building peace digital world. I'll go throughout my presentation. I'll talk about these two concepts, as well as my very recent participation in an interesting research project. It was called DMAPS, organized and presented by Built Up, which is a non-governmental organization and funded by British Council. Mr. Andrew was one of the amazing member of the technical team who developed, let's say, a tool system that really helped us as digital peace builders in terms of identifying all the issues and all as well as designing interventions to resolve them. So I will be presenting my part, and then Mr. Andrew will walk you through all the technicalities of that tool that was really helpful. So firstly, peace and conflicts have been the two most long-standing themes and marks in our lives, in everyone's societies around the world. It depends where you live, I get that. For example, I am from a region, the Middle East, which is known for its longstanding conflicts, whether it's religious, ethnic, sectarian. They have been there because it's a really, as we call it, a hot area in terms of climate as well as in terms of ongoing conflicts. Sometimes they get really violent, and this is what really concerns people, both inside the region and outside the region, as they depend on the region for a lot of its resources and the connections and the geographic similarity. So it's not new. That's my message. Peace and conflict are not nothing new that we are discussing today. What is new to us, what has become a new trend, is talking and discussing these concepts in the digital world. We are very invested in technology and in its advancement, but unfortunately, little attention has been given to all these consequences that result from this technological advancement. Peace and conflict are two parts of this issue that have been given less attention. So if we define peace, I think anyone can have a definition of its own. But the definition that I picked up, and I believe this, that really fits the concept of peace, is it's not only about the absence of violence. It's not enough for the weapons to cease fire. It's more than that. It's a climate. It's an atmosphere in societies that people feel they can thrive, they can develop themselves, they can grow. That's peace. It's a kind of situation where you feel secure, where you can predict a foreseeable future, and you feel, you have the sense that this is going to be the case for a long time. On the other hand, we have conflict, which is basically, it's a clash of opposing feelings or needs. That's very simple. We see that conflict in every aspect of our lives, as we see later. So what is the difference that's going to be the next question, and I know that many of you might have it on your minds. What's the difference between this peace building effort in real life and digitally? And that's an important question, and I think that's the main theme of this talk that I'm giving right now. There are similarities, for sure, but the differences are the differences are the things that make this effort unique and requires our special attention. In real life, we see that diplomats, politicians, researchers, university lecturers, and from the academic community generally, come together to discuss the issues that their societies suffer from. And it's usually conflicts between the members of their society. And we know the actors, we know who are the opposing sides, what are their needs, what are their frustrations and concerns. They come together to discuss those issues in detail and to find solutions. Unfortunately, sometimes they lead nowhere. The only thing they lead to is the continuation of conflicts that turns into violence, and it could be very deadly. But in digital era or world, peace building has become very challenging because of two main reasons. There are other reasons, definitely, but two main ones, in my opinion, I think are obstacles or challenges, big challenges for the process, are first, rapid flow of information, given the technological advancement we have, and second is the multiplicity of actors. We can, in real life, we can have one opposing actor, for example, representing a community. Okay, it could be a political party, it could be an organization, it could be, any sort of other entity. In the digital world, that person, let's say, or that entity could multiply due to the enormous access that social media gives you to represent yourself, or digital world in general terms, through websites, through, you know, our focus is more on social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and other social media networks. It gives you an enormous, opportunity to represent yourself through multiple channels, through multiple tools that you can amplify your voices. So this is also a blessing, but at the same time, a really big challenge when it comes to digital peace building, because you deal with an enormous a significant source of people or entities that try to push forward their causes, as well as might use all that that opportunity to attack the opposing sides. What we really did in our project with BuildUp was to firstly analyze landscape. Who are the opposing sides? What they need? What are their frustrations, concerns? What are their narratives that they use? And I'll go into the more detail when it comes to the project I took part in. And there are also, in addition to the challenges, we have, you know, tools at our disposal that we can use in order to tackle those challenges. So that's the bright, that's the good news here. One of the tools that was also part of that project I really benefited from was network or actor mapping in the digital world. So who are the actors? Who are the opposing actors? What they want, you know, where they are located, and what they say, what they write, and all this kind of information is very, very crucial for understanding the conflict, for analyzing it, for even forecasting its trends, as well as, most importantly, to design interventions. If you want to deal with this challenge, if you want to build peace digitally, you really need this is also a tool, as well as a necessity that you need to have at your disposal in order to tackle this challenge of this multiplicity of actors, which is on, you know, a huge magnitude. You really need to analyze and group them together and see who are they and what they want. So in the official term, let's say, is the network or actor mapping. That's one of them. The second one is, I think, part of any day-to-day life of a digital peace builder. It's the ongoing social media monitoring. It is similar to the life of a journalist, that I have, that you have to be constantly aware of the situations, developments, whether political, economic, or any other sort of developments that take place around you. You need to have that awareness to see what's going on. Sometimes it's not for the sake of your work. It is a habit. It will become like a habit for you to follow all these developments. So later, you feel that you can that will be useful for you in terms of being aware of all the trends that are taking place. So for the digital business builders, similarly, this is also a case that they have to have that high awareness of what's going on in their societies, in terms of, you know, who are the actors, the channels, the media organizations that have a big presence on social media, and they can affect people's perceptions on many aspects, or whether they are a source of spreading hatred, fake news, misinformation, hate speech, and all of that. That all comes from an ongoing social media monitoring. For example, in our project with BuildUp, we had another tool that we used during the research project was narrative analysis. Okay, you have monitored, you have the actor map, you have mapped out the actors, the entities that are opposing sides to each other. And you have the information, what they write about, how they want to lead societies or people, and how they want to affect people's perceptions. But what is now here? That's called narrative analysis. Then you come and analyze all their talks or the perceptions, what that means. But sometimes it could be indirect. You won't be lucky to find someone directly threatening another group, or a person, or a member of a religious group. You can't, sometimes you can't find direct religious, you know, hatred comments. It could be, you know, very indirect and subtle. For example, in this example that's on the screen, this is a poster published by a very famous Iraqi television called Al-Sharqiyya, which has a lot of followers and viewers, both on social media and on TV. In one post that's about COVID-19 infections, they chose a picture of members of a particular sect in Iraq during the religious ceremony. And they wrote on it that Iraqi Ministry of Health warns of increase in COVID-19 infections. Nothing. There is nothing wrong with this statement, right? What is wrong is the choice of the photo for that statement. And all the people here knows that this is this photo is taken, or these you know, ladies are performing a religious ritual, and the negative let's say perception that it gives very indirectly, that blaming this sort of religious rituals and members of that that group to be a source of spreading COVID-19. However, these religious ceremonies were halted during the pandemic, but this is the kind of danger that you will expose during your narrative analysis, by analyzing it, by understanding the motive behind these kinds of statements that are put out here. We have another issue in the digital world that's for any digital peace builders, and they have to tackle, and they have to face it generally, is the issue of hate speech, misinformation, and disinformation. My country, my region, is not devoid of this. I know it's a global issue nowadays. Sometimes, you know, societies and other are lucky to have correct tools at their disposal to tackle this issue. Unfortunately, in our parts of the world, this is still a growing awareness raising issue that we are dealing with. But what I can say that hate speech and misinformation, I've always said that it's vital. It can kill people. I've seen it, and this is also a case here, that people, groups have been discriminated, even killed, based on misinformation, disinformation, and speech. And I believe it's an important aspect for any digital peace builder to deal with. Of course, challenging misinformation is one way, you know, to tackle this issue. And that challenging could be through debunking misinformation, disinformation on a particular social media platforms. There are a few organizations that do that in Iraq. Hopefully they are growing, and it could be in the comment section sometimes. that you have a team, or you as an individual, you see a post, you comment on it, you try to, particularly or replying to you know, comments from other people, other commentators, to raise that awareness. This is fake. Be careful, and you provide evidence, for example. So all sorts of these steps could be taken to tackle this. Or it could be one-on-one conversation. Sometimes in terms of in the subject of hate speech, you know, some people targeting another group in the comment section, as we dealt with, and this was my particular focus. It was under my particular focus. How can I work to in order to tackle the issue of hate speech against religious minorities in Iraq? In the comment sections of many posts that were about, you know, their religious feast and ritual, where people were fanatics, were attacking them and shaming them and spreading misinformation, disinformation. One way we, my team and I took was to try to speak to those kind of people and telling them, This is not true. People are not like that. But also, that conversation is, I compare it to a talk therapy. You really can't force them to speak. You really can't just say, no, you're wrong. No, it's not going to work like that. You need to speak to them peacefully in order to reveal their frustrations. It could be in the comment section. It could be in your private direct messages or any other tool, in order to let them tell you their frustrations, and then you can challenge those thoughts through that, or paranoia if they have any. So as part of the Digital Media Arts for an Inclusive Public Sphere project, DMAPS, it was a huge and a significant steps towards digital business building, because it equipped us as people from Iraq and Kurdistan region with the necessary tools, with the necessary process that can help us in identifying as well as designing interventions for this issue. And as part of the program, I was with my colleague Andrew. The technical team developed a system or process or tool in order to help us or the BIS builders to achieve our goal, which is identifying and analyzing and designing interventions, and also following up on the interventions we make. My colleague Andrew will walk you through all the technicalities of the talk, and I'll come back later to share my experience with that great system, It's time to present Spark. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Perfect. Thanks, Navar. So as he said, my name is Andrew Sajayo. I'm a data scientist. I've been for 7 years. Also the chair of Correlate Netherlands, which is an NGO which brings data science to other NGOs. On top of that, I'm also a partner at a end-to-end machine learning consultancy called Data Value People. And together with them, we helped build up Create Phoenix, which is a technical platform to help local peace builders respond to social media. So as the far said, we have these problem statements that come from local peace builders. There's a multitude of things that they can do, interventions that they can do, but there are so many people and so many places where these interventions can be placed. How do we make sure that the intervention that we're placing is going to the right place, and if it's the correct intervention at all? For that, we need to munch through data. So the thing that I'm going to be talking about is the data pipeline to get all that data in, how to get automatic labeling models to reduce the manual organization of the data, and how to get a dashboard to get this information to local peace builders. Next slide, please. For the computer scientists among us, this can look familiar. It's also quite a standard structure for a data pipeline. We have data coming in. For us, it's social media. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube event data. We need to get it into our system, which we call raw. We need to organize it, anonymize it, do some inference on it so that it can provide value to Devar. To be able to do that, we also need some manual labeling. And once everything is processed, it needs to be shown on the dashboard. Next slide, please. So yeah, data sources. Again, if you have a CS background, I'm sorry, this is going to be quite shallow. But we have APIs, application programmatic interfaces, ways for code to contact Twitter or YouTube so that we can get the data in. One thing to note is Facebook and Instagram used to come from the CrowdTangle API, which Meta published. However, due to bad PR, they are discontinuing it, probably. So right now we're applying for Facebook Graph API, which hopefully will get us the same thing. That's where most of the data comes in. Some things we aren't able to get through APIs, which we'll need to manually scrape, in this case, Facebook comments. We created a small plugin where people like Devar can look at a post and look at comments, and while they're scrolling through comments, we screen grab it and take the comments in to our system. Beyond that, we also have databases, in this case, the ACLED, which stands for the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, which is a near real-time data of reported political violence and protest events, has locations, dates, actors, fatalities, and what type of conflict it is. What we do is we get it all in. We don't change anything at all. No modifications. Save it as is, either in JSON or, for us, Parquet. Next slide, please. Now, the organization. This is 80% of my work, but we'll run through it in one slide. So we organize things because we want to be able to compare and contrast between different platforms. We also don't want to repeat pieces of code to process each platform separately. So what we do is we map things that are similar between platforms into one structure. So discourse, while tweets have a character limit of 280, I believe now, and YouTube comments and Facebook posts don't. They're all snippets of text that people are using to speak on the internet. So we can map that into a bit of discourse data. Same thing for authors. So whether it's a Facebook profile or a Twitter handle or a YouTube account, it's all a person or a thing that places this snippet of text online. Important is that we map only what we need. Everything else we keep, but we keep separate. And for this, you can think of unofficial retweets in Twitter, where you put an RT at the start, or certain reactions in Facebook, like haha or LOL or whatever. There's no real easy way to map that to everything else. It might be interesting at a later point, but it doesn't map cleanly into. It doesn't map cleanly into one structure. Here we save them as Parquet files. If you want more tech questions, ask me later. Next slide, please. This, to me, is the fun part as a data scientist. Automatic classification inference. So the overarching and fundamental aim for us is to build a model or a representation or theory of the system that we have an interest in. In this case, we're aiming to build a representation of the dynamics and drivers of conflict within societies from how they're played out in discourse in the digital public space. Then you can use that model or theory to ask it, firstly, what will happen with this system in the future, or what's likely to happen with the system in the future, and secondly, what's likely to happen in the future if we were to take a certain action to affect the system. So in our case, we want to be able to ask something like, oh, please go back. we want to ask it something like, how might we affect the system if we do initiative X? Now, these theories or representations of systems will be something between precise mathematical models and fully qualitative and fuzzy theories. Now, to do that, we need to be able to view what's going on in that system at a level that's higher than the micro level. To create an analogy, if you want to understand what's happening in a forest, you don't always consider every tree as an individual. You try to categorize them into species, and then try to look at aggregated data, or more macro level metrics and properties of the system. So for this forest, we can ask what proportion of the forest is oak tree. In the same way, we want to be able to ask what proportion of the discourse in the data sets that we've crawled is about the economy, or about gender, or about sectarianism. Now, to answer that question of what proportion of the discourse is about gender, we need to find a way to efficiently identify which of these discourse data points are about gender. So this is where automatic classification tools and models come in. We ask the piece builders to develop a taxonomy that's specific to their research question. Ask them then to manually label a small sample of the scraped data, and we then use that manual data set to build a general classification model. Next slide, please. This is what it looks like. It's a bootstrapped Google Sheets, because the first thing you do is you find whatever works. This has tweets in the chronological order. They can read the text and say, hey, is this about gender, sectarianism, economy, or other, irrelevant? We also give them the option to say, all right, there are certain keywords in there, which mean that if you see this in any text, it's always about sectarianism, as well as, okay, there's a keyword here that usually means it's about sectarianism, but not always. Next slide, please. Once we have this, this annotated data, we can make rule-based and statistical classification models for a number of different things: text relevance, subject topics, hate speech, types of conflict, and online behavior. And we also ask them to make actor and affiliation labels from a pre-identified list. With this, we can then run this on the rest of the data set that they haven't seen before, haven't annotated, to get classified labels for all the data. So with this, we can go a level deeper and ask not just how many, but how are oak trees distributed within the forest? Are they evenly spread out? Are they in tight clusters? Analogously, we can ask, okay, in what areas of the network are individuals that are speaking about gender? Is that discussion localized to certain groups of accounts? Is it localized to certain people? So the answers to this question help us build that representation or theory of the system, and that allows us to gain that insight into what an effective initiative could be to affect that system for the better. Next slide, please. So what's the value of this? In the overarching game, it's to take all this fine-grained data, build a high-level representation of it. You could read every single post if you had infinite patience and infinite time, but we don't. So we need to be able to compress that data down into something that's consumable to humans. Same way that if you want to understand a forest, you don't analyze every single leaf. Now, there are many open source models out there that compress data into something that's consumable by us, and a lot of them are very good. We use this to improve our own inferences. Improve being the operative word here, as all open source models are trained for a use case that's slightly different than ours. So an open source model might be very good at boiling down whether a particular discourse data point has a positive emotion or a negative emotion attached to it. What it won't be good at is understanding the localized context and building that representation that we want. Hate speech and the words that are used to display that hate speech are different in different countries and regions. And it's something that I, as a data scientist or a programmer from the Netherlands, know nothing about. And it's something that I don't have enough knowledge for to create a representation for. What I can do is I can facilitate the flow of information into the system from people like Tavar, people that are part of that context, people that are steeped in that conflict or are part of that community. Next slide. Actually, go two more, because we don't have enough time for this. So let me take you through this dashboard in general case. What this dashboard allows you to do is to slice and dice based on sentiment, based on peace builder defined classes such as sectarianism or religion, and look into date and cross-reference with things such as the ACLED database. It's currently made on AWS QuickSight, but we're moving towards Apache Superset because free and open source software. But to showcase how it's used further, I'd like to hand over back to Tavar.
Great, thank you very much, Andrew. On the dashboard that we had and we really took advantage of was in terms of targeting interventions, in terms of, for example, in one case, we wanted to find out which media organizations based in Iraq across the whole country that have posts, even their own posts and the comment section that have a lot of negative sentiments. And we were able to identify them easily without going through all of these pages. And the system gave us, you know, the top five pages that had that attracted during a certain period of time that you can choose a lot of negative sentiments, and then you can narrow down later to see against whom and what were the reactions. How were because we had different sentiments in the system. For the other part of the project was also about using the dashboard to design the intervention, as I did later. When I made an awareness raising video and also online campaign that was wholly based on the results we got from the dashboard. So in conclusion, I want to say that digital business building is, if it's not already the case, it's an integral part in of future conflict resolution methods. I think this is the most important part of it, that we have to sooner or later deal with it. So, and that's why as a local peace builder, I'm 100% for encouraging this effort and improving it, because that's the future of conflict resolution. Thank you very much for your time. I hope it was useful. And if you have any questions, comments, that we missed something in the presentation, we would like to get it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the interesting insights in your work. And it was amazing how you show how technology and humans interact and build together, because often technology is understood as solving problems on its own, but it's always needs intelligence, how to build it and also how to use it and put it into practice. It was a very interesting example for it. To the audience, are there already questions to the talk? Otherwise, I would ask, there are many technical aspects, and one of them would be you said that if you analyze the discourse, you normalize it. So then I would ask, is this a kind of finding double posts and bots, for instance, or to bind it back to the real posters, or what would be the focus of normalizing the Twitter post, for instance?
It's less for that. I mean, we also do that, but that's a side effect for it. The main reason for us to normalize things back is we want to build a data set of this is an interesting corpus of data for us, so for a particular research question. As I said before, we have lots of open source models which work very well, but for us to get something that's useful for Devar or any other local peace builder, we need to rebuild that corpus and retrain the model to help understand differences between the data set that we're looking at and whatever the previous model was trained on. I'm not too sure if that answers your question. So it's mostly a data set gathering effort.
Yeah, my question was in the direction that that you have the danger of a misrepresentation of discourses in social media, because if you have a small amount of people who are very well organized, then things can look much more relevant than they might be in practice, and I wondered if this would be one aspect of your data normalization
Not really. I mean, it's always going to be inherently biased, also by the way that we do our analysis. So we don't have access to a Twitter firehose. We ask them, okay, what actors are important to you? What actors do you see? And from there, we try to expand it to a small subset of the public online discourse. So we're always going to have that bias, but by picking and choosing actors that are important to the particular conflict, you're able to create this narrative analysis around a conflict that they've already specified. I've gone on a tangent.
No, it's fine. I think it's getting clearer now. Is there another question? I would just open the room for questions. I have a lot of, but yeah, there's one question from the audience.
Hello. Yeah. Thank you for the interesting presentation. Maybe you said it, but I missed it somehow. The categories, how many did you have? How many labels did you have? How many different ones and which ones?
There's a difference between labels and classes. So for classes, that depends on each of the groups that we serviced. So Devar, I think you had about 10? Religion, sectarianism, something like that?
Yes. We had one about sectarianism. We had one about religious hatred. I think these two about, that was close to each other, but we have we had ethnic and others too.
Yeah, so roughly between 5 and 10 per group that we helped, and then labeled data, we had a couple of thousand tweets or posts that we used to train a model.
Maybe let me ask another question. I still have. It's not so easy to make up my mind how it really is in practice. There are two things. One, how would you in your local work? How would you see that the social media discourse is really so impacting your daily work? How strong is this interrelation? And the second one, or maybe you want to ask to answer directly.
Okay. I mean, in terms of my as a journalist, you mean, and how social media is affecting, you know, my profession. I deal with it every day. It's part of my work, you know, to debunk, to see the, you know, misinformation, to detect them, mis or disinformation, and also what we're really focusing on right now is, especially after the research project I took part in, is just to build an awareness about, for example, we report something on a religious fest or ritual of a particular religious group inside our region. We try to, when we report it, we try in the background information, we try to provide accurate information about the event, about the rituals, why they do it, and what's their significance for its people. Because this is the awareness we want to build through journalism to our audience. It, in my opinion, it was in the absence of this accurate information, and it's in the absence of it that misinformation, disinformation grows, and people take the chance to target them. So to wrap up my answer is that I think it's closely interrelated, and I can't really do my work without monitoring social media, all the trends, and trying my part, without trying contributing to fix it, even if it's little, I think it's a collaboration, an announced one. But it's part of my work.
Mm-hmm. And if there's no other questions from the audience, I would ask, beyond your work as a journalist, is there also a link to more to or how can I imagine the link to civil organization groups? Is there interest in monitoring media and interacting then in real life operations, interactions?
Yeah, with regards to this question, which is an interesting one, in Iraq generally and in my region, Kurdistan region, there is a growing appetite for monitoring social media platforms, because people are getting aware of the dangers. We've already enjoyed the significance of it, the positive side of it. I think people are now waking up to see it could be really dangerous in terms of misinformation, in terms of disinformation, in terms of hate speech. And there are people, you know, especially young people, are grouping up some of them are just online initiatives. Others are actual civil society organizations. One of them, who is also part of the research project with us, was Tech for Peace, based in Baghdad, the capital of the country. They did an amazing job, and they are still doing it in terms of, they're also monitoring our channel as well for any misinformation or inaccurate. And they post it, and they once they post it on their platform, which has a lot of audience and followers, they try to aware people of fake news, of misinformation, inaccurate sometimes. So I believe it's a growing. We are in a growing stage. It's not fully developed. But I understand this is because of lack of awareness, which is now, you know, starting to garner that momentum.
Yeah. And to add to that, the DMAPS project that we were a part of, it wasn't just myself and Devar and Build Up and Tech for Peace. We had, I think, 19 or 20 local peacemakers around the Middle East and North Africa, Jordan, Libya, all jumping on this opportunity to understand the digital public sphere and figure out what kinds of interventions they can place on it.
Okay, thank you. And maybe a last question. We as a fifth local group, for instance, how we could make use of your system?
It's free and open source software. So
great, because I missed the GitHub link. Maybe
it's a GitLab link. I'll make sure it gets to you.
Yeah, fine. Good, thank you. Yeah, thanks very much for the presentation. Maybe you give a warm applause to the
Thank you both.